This is Taking Aim with
Rav Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Dysfunctional Capitalist State, Part 5, The Annihilation of Afghanistan. Before we start our topic today, the annihilation of Afghanistan, let's return to Ralph Poynter for an update on the case of Lynn Stewart. Ralph?
Hey, hi, Maya and Ralph. How are you this morning? I visited Lynn yesterday, and that was Monday, and she's in good spirits. Her phone and email prohibition ends in 2 weeks. You know that story. Her cellmate made a phone call to me because she hadn't returned from the hospital for the third time. They took their privileges for 90 days, both of them. And the appeals have gone nowhere, but Lynn said it'll be over in 2 weeks. She went on with discussing the significance of the case where the Guantanamo lawyers disregarded a court order regulating how they were to conduct the defense of the detainees. And as you know, court orders are legal documents much more powerful than the SAMs, as prison regulations, and how the government's lack of any response to this occurrence can and should have a great impact on her case. But she did break into tears, remembering the obvious injustices done to our own political prisoners, such as Leonard Peltier, Mumia, Abu Jamal, and others. But she wiped her tears away and then talked to me about my mistakes in handling her case in publicity. She sent a letter to be posted on her website, making it clear that the letter should be sent to the Defense Committee. That's Ralph Poynter, the Defense Committee, 1070 Dean Street, Brooklyn, New York, 11216 office. I told her that I had requested a copy of all letters sent to the judge to be sent to the Defense Committee. Her mail reached a low point last week when she didn't receive any mail in or out other than the letters we discussed last week. That is, people asking her to recommend leftist training camps. Remember, all mail is censored. And put that together with the birthday card with the $20 bill I sent to her niece in Portland, Oregon, ended up at the prison in her mail. Money is contraband in prison, and you know where that goes. And her eyeglasses will be the most traveled eyeglasses in history. Over 2 months, and she hasn't received them. But we think that the situation appears to have been improved by the lawyers in the last 2 or 3 days. But she has no glasses yet. She's uplifted by the indications that people in general becoming more aware of the government game of empire, projecting terror, and taking the money to the top. She asked about articles of our progressive community dealing with the Wall Street Journal article, and I was unable to give her any report on that, but I assured her that you would be continuing dealing with that, and I would be making calls to newspapers.
Well, it's a critical matter, as you've been indicating, and as Lynn certainly is very clear about, the significance of this article in the Wall Street Journal that was called The Indefensible Lawyers, and the people who wrote that article, let it be noted, are part of a CIA front that has been orchestrating the war on terror. And the attack on the lawyers of Paul Weiss Rifkin and Garrison, and specifically Julia Tarver Mason, concerns, as you indicate, that they have defied a court order and have refused to abide by the demand that they prevent their own clients from being aware of the nature of the government's evidence and the character of the treatment of detainees across the world, sending these detainees in Guantanamo, whom they represent, the Amnesty International reports on the ubiquitousness of torture and arbitrary detention, sending them a list of the other detainees, which the military has been trying to conceal from those they are holding in virtual sensory deprivation. It's an open defiance of the arbitrary and totalitarian restrictions that have been imposed upon the attorneys. Goes actually far beyond what Lynn and Ramsey did with respect to the SAMs, namely using the media to communicate the nature of the case and the concerns of the sheikh, which is a part of the normal defense of a client, for which Lynn is to be sentenced to decades in prison. So the implications of this open defiance of the court order are enormous for Lynn's case.
I think we have to add to the open defiance of the court order that the attorneys have not yet, as of yesterday, received a letter. They didn't receive an arrest. They were not attacked by the government. They were not threatened by the government, as Lynn was. They didn't receive a letter from the government saying, you broke the court order. So that tells you something about selective prosecution. It tells you about equal justice under the law. It tells you about a lot of things that the lawyers are grappling with as to how to best use this. The government has picked Lynn to be the person that they would go after. And, of course, as you explained over and over again, the reason for that, she is the template case for all of these terrorist cases. You send in some informer to arrange everything, hook a few other people's names into it, and then you have a terrorist case. And as many others have said, because of her years of representing the poor and dispossessed, those that have no voice, her political attitude, when she says, I am of the Nelson Mandela form of resistance rather than the Martin Luther King, this makes these people crazy. This is why they're after her. Her 30 years of representation are just more than they felt they could tolerate. Lynn stays involved, whether she's in prison or out of prison, and she wants to thank everybody so much for so much work that they've done, especially you and Maya. It goes on. The struggle continues, and she says, don't be down, be up, because the people seem to be coming.
Thanks, Ralph. We'll be with you again next week, and again, remind our listeners of the address for
Lynn
reaching Lynn.
Lynn Stewart, LynnStewart, 150 Park Row, New York, New York, MCC, that's Manhattan Correctional Center, 10007, 53504-054, 2 South. Put your return address on it because she will write. She has been getting so much from all over the world due to the work that you have been doing and many others. So thank you from my heart. Movement has gotten up close and personal.
Thanks, Ralph. And now to our program, The Dysfunctional Capitalist State, Part 5, The Annihilation of Afghanistan. As the United States troops ready themselves for a major attack on the second largest city in Afghanistan, Kandahar, President Obama makes a stealth visit to Afghanistan. But let's look back 12 years, February 12, 1998. In Congress, the Subcommittee on Asia and Pacific. Here's testimony from John J. Maresca, the Vice President of International Relations of UNICAL. Before Maresca spoke, Mr. Baruta, who's presiding for the subcommittee, makes a statement. Quote, 100 years ago, Central Asia was the arena for a great game played by Tsarist Russia, colonial Britain, and Napoleon's France, and the Persian and Ottoman empires. 100 years later, Mr. Baruta states, the collapse of the Soviet Union has unleashed a great game where the interests of the East India Trading Company have been replaced by those of UNICAL and SOCAL. John J. Maresca, the Vice President of International Relations of UNICAL, is very forthcoming. Maresca states, the Caspian Sea contains tremendous untapped hydrocarbon reserves. Just to give an idea of the scale, the proven gas reserves equal more than 236 trillion cubic feet. The region's total oil reserves will reach more than 60 billion barrels of oil in the short term, and the estimates are as high as 200 billion barrels. The major problem, he states, has yet to be resolved. And listen carefully to the words of John Maresca. Quote, how to gain control and to get the region's vast energy resources to markets where they are needed. Maresca then talks about a consortium of 11 foreign oil companies, including UNICAL, Amoco, Exxon, and Pennzoil. What's important is the role of Afghanistan. Maresca informs the Congressional Committee, quote, we contemplate a pipeline south from Central Asia to the Indian Ocean. The only possible route is across Afghanistan, which presents its own unique challenges, because the country is involved in bitter warfare for almost two decades and is divided by civil war. We have made it clear that construction of this pipeline will not begin until a recognized government has been put in place that has the confidence of governments, lenders, and our company. Ralph?
Well, Maya, this was discussed, as you know, in my broadcast on WBAI in 2001, shortly after the September 11th attacks, called World Trade Center Uncensored History. Critical to this was Charles Ritchie of the Washington-based Center for Public Integrity, who put his finger on the real nature of state power in capitalist America and the war drive they require. Quote, George W. Bush will benefit financially from his administration's decisions and through his father's investments. Where does that take us with respect to the war in Afghanistan? Global businessmen, Bush Sr., Jim Baker, care about who runs Afghanistan, not because it's a home base for anything opposed to the population of the United States, and it's in the middle of their own interests, a region with huge amounts of oil. By 2050, Central Asia will account for more than 80% of U.S. oil, according to the industry publication Oil and Gas Journal. Brothers and sisters, this is a long discussion, and the ample documentation pertaining to it we will come back to in the future, but I want to cite the following. On the subject of the World Trade Center attack, Caspian oil and gas, and the Afghanistan pipeline connection, John Flanders wrote at the time, "We in the United States consider the oil as the security consideration, and we are going to go after it by any means necessary, regardless of other considerations or other values." There's an article at the time in The Hindu. U.S. Government Energy Information Fact Sheet on Afghanistan, dated 2000, stated, "Afghanistan's significance for us from an energy standpoint stems from its geographic position as the transit route for oil and natural gas exports from Central Asia to the Arabian Sea. This includes multi-billion dollar oil and gas export pipelines through Afghanistan. The Caspian Sea region with its oil and gas resources allows us $4 trillion of short-term profit." U.S. News and World Report cited Cheney as CEO of Halliburton as a major player. But not only that, Chevron and Unocal, and it's instructive to note, brothers and sisters, that on the board of this was not only Condoleezza Rice, the then Secretary of State, but also a person named Hamid Karzai. Karzai was on the board of directors. He was part of this corporate apparatus. He was their man in Afghanistan before he was a figure in Afghanistan of any note. And it should be added here, brothers and sisters, that the overall plan for Afghanistan was limbed out in the late 1990s and 2000 before the pretext of an attack on the World Trade Center imputed to Osama bin Laden, and we have addressed that repeatedly, the false flag nature of all of that. But as the Army Times put it at the time, the 10th Mountain Brigade takes its storied history with them into Central Asia. And it quotes a story out of Fort Drum, New York, that in the winter of 1945, intrepid soldiers scaled a sheer 1,500-foot cliff under the cover of darkness. A half century later, the ever-ready infantry division is being prepared to join America's battles, where they will be used in Uzbekistan to maintain security for Air Force fighters, but in preparation for our seizure of Afghanistan. The roots of Afghanistan's annihilation lie in the desperate ambitions of imperialism, and the plan is not merely for Afghanistan, as was stipulated over and over, as was stated, this was the beginning of a war that would last many generations and that over 60 countries were targeted in the process. 60 countries.
Ralph, let's fast forward to last week. Sneaking in and out of Kabul under the cover of darkness. He was boarded inside a closed hangar to prevent unauthorized U.S. military personnel from even learning of the president's departure. A 13-hour trip to Afghanistan, arriving in the dark for a 6-hour visit, leaving with the rise of the sun. He spoke in a closed hangar to 2,000 U.S. troops wearing, I should remark, a bombardier jacket reminiscent of President Bush on the aircraft carrier some years before, and then by helicopter secreted away to the secure presidential palace of the original U.S. man in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, who the U.S. at this point has been trying to depose. Obama's speech to the U.S. troops at Bagram, quote, "Al-Qaeda and their extremist allies are a threat to the people of Afghanistan and a threat to the people of America, but they're also a threat to people around the world. This is the U.S. mission, according to President Obama, reiterating the message of President Bush before him. The U.S. mission, he states explicitly, is, quote, to disrupt and dismantle, defeat and destroy al-Qaeda and its extremist allies, end quote. And he says this while throughout the press, the military is quoted as saying there are but 100 al-Qaeda militants functioning in Afghanistan. Yet Obama continues, the mission is to reverse the Taliban's momentum in Afghanistan and strengthen the Afghan government and security forces. We're going to deny al-Qaeda safe haven. We're going to reverse the Taliban's momentum. Ralph?
Well, let me return briefly, Maya, to the Hindu on October 13, 2001. In the article, America, Oil, and Afghanistan by Suparan Goteri, he comes right to the point. It has finally happened. American imperialism has begun its unilateral war against Afghanistan. Ominously, it has formally notified the Security Council that these military operations will expand way beyond Afghanistan, and other problem countries have been targeted. Donald Rumsfeld has spoken of a continuing war against 60 countries. It is a greater tragedy that this so-called war against terrorism, Guterres writes, will consume innocent lives in gruesome proportions. What is it that we are witnessing here? Afghanistan occupies a central position in the United States strategy for economic control of the oil and gas resources of the entire Middle East and of Central Asia. Within the next 15 to 20 years, the sources of oil and natural gas will be large enough to set off Persian Gulf oil. Turkmenistan's Karakum Desert holds the third largest gas reserves, 3 trillion cubic meters and 6 billion barrels of oil reserves. These are but the little amounts of oil and gas that will generate trillions of profit, and nothing is going to stand in their way, wrote Guterres at the time. And it's instructive to note, Maya, a book that's been recently published on the CIA role in 2001 in the uprising in southern Afghanistan discloses the following. This, by the way, is a book that's been published in Holland and has had a big impact. The CIA played a key role in the rise to power of Afghan President Hamid Karzai, according to a new publication in the Netherlands. After the events of 9/11, Hamid Karzai was brought into Afghanistan from Pakistan by the CIA in the first week of October on a motorcycle headed for Uruzgan province, where his supporters of the Popozai tribe lived. The Dutch journalist Betty Dam reveals in her book Expedition Uruzgan that Karzai's luggage included satellite phones and a large sum of money provided by the CIA. Karzai and a small group of armed personnel moved to the hamlet of Durji to the northwest of the provincial capital. Hamid's whereabouts were discovered, and the CIA organized an emergency evacuation operation by helicopter and flew the future president to the safety of the Jacobabad Air Base in Pakistan. The second infiltration by Karzai was more successful. Returning to Durji this time, he had the support of a 12-man assassination team of U.S. Special Forces and a CIA team of 6 men of the Covert Special Activities Division. The book identifies the leader of this CIA team and of hitmen as Greg, and a picture of Greg and Karzai is published and describes in details the contacts between Hamid Karzai, Washington, and the CIA station in Islamabad prior to and during the uprising. So what we're looking at here, and there's much more detail concerning it, which we will address at a future time, is the hands-on control of Hamid Karzai, who is described as the puppet of America, appointed by the CIA, by Ms. Dam, and she details it. After 9/11, there were many unknowns for the U.S. in Afghanistan. Karzai, with his close contacts with the CIA, with Chevron, has acknowledged that. But the CIA was in control of his role and earmarked him for the future political control of the country.
Ralph, I found an article in Foreign Affairs, which is published by the Council on Foreign Relations, dating back to November 4th, 2009. And it's titled, Our Man in Kabul. what Hamid Karzai's rise to power means for how he will govern now. It's an instructive article. It's written by James Dobbins. He was the Bush administration's first envoy to Afghanistan, and he's now director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He's a man on the inside. And referring Our Man in Kabul to the John le Carré book, Our Man in Havana, and as we call Saddam Hussein, the CIA's man in Iraq.
For 27 years, Maya, having been deployed by the Central Intelligence Agency to assassinate Abdul Karim Qasim, who had been the principal figure in the revolution in Iraq in 1958, who confined the oil companies to 0.1% of the territory of Iraq, was earmarked for murder. Saddam Hussein was their instrument. 27 years, their murder man in Baghdad, the agent of U.S. imperialism at the time.
Let's look at what Dobbins is saying about Karzai. First off, Karzai was a leader of a royalist faction and of a Pashtun militia. He was suggested to become the head of Afghanistan and president through his connections with the Northern Alliance, the militia leaders that banded together with Zbigniew Brzezinski to remove the Soviet-aligned powers in Afghanistan.
Well, Maya, actually, you're talking here about the warlords in the north and a close associate of course, not merely the CIA, but of Karzai himself, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. And at the time, the small little group associated with Osama bin Laden that the CIA was sponsoring and funding, they gave something like $50 billion to this apparatus. Al-Qaeda was always a fiction. It was always a facade. It exists in any sense at all today. It's a random number of people. And, of course, Osama bin Laden has been dead for at least a decade. All of this is shadows and charade to provide the facade for the long-established plans for dominion and for devastation in the area. We have to address this now in a very particular context, Maya, namely what is going on with respect to the U.S. attempts to both eliminate and kill Hamid Karzai.
Yes, Ralph. And it was Abdullah Abdullah, who has now fallen out with Karzai, who at the time was the Northern Alliance foreign minister, who first suggested Karzai become president of Afghanistan. And he coordinated with the other Northern Alliance leaders and then also with the imperialist diplomats, as well as diplomats from India, Iran, and Russia. And until he brought everyone on board as they gathered in Bonn, Germany, for a UN-sponsored conference that established the new Afghanistan government. Karzai consolidated his power, first as the interim president chosen by the Loya Jirga in 2002, and then in the so-called elections to the presidency in 2004. Ralph, let's fast forward to the current situation.
Well, Maya, on the 29th of March, the headline in the New York Times was, Afghan leader is seen to flout influence of the United States. This month, with President Hamid Karzai looking ahead to a visit to the White House, he received a terse note from aides to President Obama. Your invitation has been revoked. The reason, according to American officials, was Mr. Karzai's announcement that he was emasculating an independent panel that had discovered widespread fraud in Mr. Karzai's re-election last year. Incensed, Mr. Karzai extended an invitation of his own to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, who flew to Kabul and delivered a fiery anti-American speech inside Afghanistan's presidential palace. Karzai was outraged, said Afghans with knowledge of the events who spoke on condition of anonymity. He invited Ahmadinejad to flout the Americans. The dispute was supposed to be smoothed over when Mr. Obama flew to Kabul for a surprise dinner with Mr. Karzai. But the red carpet treatment of Mr. Ahmadinejad is but one example. Mr. Karzai is putting great distance between himself and his American sponsors, prominent Afghans and American officials have stated. even as Mr. Obama pours tens of thousands of additional troops into the country. Mr. Karzai voices the view that his interests and those of the United States no longer coincide. Neither Mr. Karzai nor his spokesman, Waheed Omar, could be reached, but according to Afghan associates, Karzai told lunch guests at the presidential palace that the Americans are in Afghanistan because they want to dominate and destroy my country and the region. They pose an obstacle to striking any peace arrangement. During the American-dominated military offensive in the town of Marjah, the largest of the war, Mr. Karzai stood aside and in the shadows. He did not support it. Recently, the behavior of Mr. Karzai, the Times continues, offers the latest illustration of the central dilemma that the Obama administration faces in Afghanistan. How to influence the actions of an ally who they regard increasingly as unreliable without undermining America's ultimate goals. In January, Mr. Karzai invited 24 prominent Afghan media and business figures to lunch at the palace, where he expressed deep cynicism and anger about America's motives and of the burden he bears trying to keep the United States at bay. Quote, "He has developed a complete theory of American power," stated an Afghan who attended the lunch and who spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of retribution. "He states that America is trying to dominate the region, and he is now the only one who can stand up to them." Mr. Karzai said left alone, he would come to an arrangement with the Taliban, but the United States refuses to allow him. "The United States' goal is to keep the Afghan conflict going indefinitely and thereby to allow American troops to stay permanently in the country." The description of the lunch was affirmed by two other Afghans who declined to be identified. The person who described the meeting said that participants urged Mr. Karzai to reconsider his views, stating, "We are a poor country. We are depending on the United States." Mr. Karzai refused. Maya?
This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Dysfunctional Capitalist State, Part 5, The Annihilation of Afghanistan. Ralph, there have been several meetings between Hamid Karzai and Ahmadinejad of Iran. Ahmadinejad was invited to Afghanistan. Then Karzai makes various speeches, particularly trying to gain further control of the Electoral Commission, eliminating the UN-picked representatives on the panel, and stating that he should have full control of the Electoral Commission. Then, when the parliament overturns Karzai's desires to have full control, he then makes further statements, which we will discuss, and he goes to Iran for a joint celebration. Obama gives him very little notice that he is coming to set him straight, traveling this 13-hour quick stealth trip to Afghanistan. This is after refusing to have Karzai come to the United States, disinviting him. And Karzai gets to Afghanistan just hours before Obama's arrival. Let's look at the details. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. Karzai slams West, threatens to join insurgency. This is a report on April 4th. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has often resorted to playing an anti-West card in speeches when his popularity seems to be flagging. As an effort to distance himself from the international occupation forces which had put him and kept him in power. But after what could be charitably called a cool reception in Kandahar, a city his family and tribal affiliates dominate, the attempts are starting to whiff of desperation. Greeted by tribal elders allied with his family, who chastised him for failing to do anything about the almost ridiculous levels of corruption, brutality, and bribery in Kandahar, whose province is dominated by Karzai's half-brother Wali, Hamid delivered a speech to local parliamentarians chastising the United States for interference in Afghanistan's politics. His speech centered on an attack on the United States and its NATO allies, and warned that if they didn't assent to his takeover of the Electoral Complaints Commission, it would allow the impression that Afghanistan was Western-dominated and controlled and grant legitimacy to the Taliban. The members of Parliament present say Karzai threatened to join the insurgency. One Afghan official called Karzai's comments shocking, and U.S. officials infuriated by Karzai's claims last week that the massive vote fraud in his favor was in reality a Western vote fraud and a conspiracy against him are complaining that the Afghan president is becoming increasingly erratic and impossible to work with. And through that, there is speculation that means Karzai is on the outs with the Obama administration. And one must not forget that twice already in the 15 months since Obama took office, there are reports that he is preparing to oust Karzai. In fact, the administration initially shrugged off over a million fraudulent votes cast on Karzai's behalf and praised the election as a success, championing Karzai's legitimacy at a time when many nations and a large chunk of the Afghan public were outraged at the disastrous vote. But what's instructive about this report, brothers and sisters, is that Karzai has fired back and said, "The manipulation of ballots has always been the specialty of the United Nations and the United States, and that the United Nations agents who were there nominally to monitor our elections are carrying out the bid of their masters in the United States. They manipulate votes, all right, because what they're trying to do is to create a basis for undermining me. They don't like the fact that I am defying them, and they are taking steps to eliminate me politically or physically."
Well, Ralph, Karzai has not fulfilled his promise. The promise was, coming in as a Northern Alliance leader, that he would be able to stabilize Afghanistan so that the oil interests could build their pipeline. But he hasn't. He barely has any control even of Kabul, the major city. And most of Afghanistan is rural. There are two cities, Kabul and Kandahar. But most of the population, 74% of the population, is rural and is controlled by these tribal leaders. In fact, the governors of each province are appointed. They're not elected. They're appointed by the president in Kabul, that is Karzai himself. But even these governors don't have control of the various provinces. They are controlled by militia leaders and tribal leaders themselves. And Karzai does not have any power. Karzai did single out the United Nations. In particular, he singled out Peter Galbraith, who was the former American deputy of the UN mission in Kabul, and he was a former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, and he influenced the views of Joseph Biden and John Kerry on Iraq, and was the advisor to the Kurdish regional government in Iraq as Iraq was writing its constitution. Ralph.
Maya. March 28, 2010, The New York Times. In Afghan trip, Obama presses Karzai on graft. President Obama personally delivered pointed criticism to Hamid Karzai in face-to-face meetings on Sunday, flying here for an unannounced visit that reflected growing vexation with Mr. Karzai as America's military commitment to defeat the insurgency has deepened. Now, who is the point man for this claim that Mr. Karzai, Hamid Karzai, has actually been guilty of corruption, as you indicate, Maya?
That is Peter W. Galbraith. If we look at the New York Times article by James Glanz and Walter Gibbs, November 12, 2009, we find interesting facts about Peter Galbraith himself.
Maya, November 12, 2009. Peter Galbraith, the influential former American ambassador, the powerful voice in Iraq who shaped the views of policymakers such as Joseph Biden and John Kerry, the advisor to the Kurdish regional government as Iraq wrote its constitution, in tough talks about issues of like how Iraq will divide its oil wealth. Mr. Galbraith, the son of the renowned economist John Kenneth Galbraith, stands to earn over $100 million as a result of his closeness to the Kurds and his relationship with the Norwegian oil company, which is in contact with the Kurds. In the constitutional negotiations, Galbraith helped Kurds ram through divisions that gave their region, rather than the central Baghdad government, exclusive authority over not only their internal affairs, but complete control over the oil and any fines on their territory. Galbraith, widely viewed in Washington as a smart and bold foreign policy expert, described himself as an unpaid advisor to the Kurds. So it came as a shock, the New York Times writes, to many last month when a group of Norwegian investigative journalists at the newspaper Dagens Næringsliv published documents linking Galbraith to a specific Norwegian oil company with major oil contracts in Iraq. Interviews by the New York Times with more than a dozen current and former government and business officials in Norway, France, Iraq, the United States, and elsewhere, along with legal records and other documents, reveal in great detail that Galbraith received rights to an enormous stake in Kurdistan's oil fields in the spring of 2004. Mr. Galbraith received the rights after negotiating a lucrative contract that allows the Norwegian oil company DNO to drill for oil in the promising Dohuk region of Kurdistan, the interviews and documents show.
Ralph Galbraith and his partner were to receive 10% of the results, Galbraith 5% and his partner 5%. His partner sold his share, and there is now arbitration in the British courts about the value of this share, and Galbraith's partner is demanding $500 million. So the New York Times article of 2009, putting the amount that Galbraith stood to earn at $100 million, is now considered five times that value.
Actually, Maya, the company that arranged all this is called Porcupine, registered in Delaware under Peter Galbraith's name, which, as you indicated, held the rights to a 5% stake, while the company associated with his partner, Mr. Rosjo, held the other 5%. And as a matter of fact, according to DNO, the claim for Galbraith represents over 10% of the value of all regional production, which the Norwegian oil firm shares with a Turkish energy company which they have established. As a matter of hard fact, Mr. Galbraith's estimate of the deal's worth may be discerned in a London arbitration case in which Porcupine and the Yemeni investor who holds Mr. Rosjo's former shares are seeking over $525 million of DNO as a modest estimate of the money and the value to which they are entitled. Oslo's first security brokerage has stated that the Tok oil field, with proven reserves of 230 million barrels, a figure that will increase as new wells are drilled, guarantees multiples of this $500 million for Galbraith and his colleague. Galbraith set policy for Iraq and Afghanistan. Galbraith is the person who defined for Joseph Biden and for John Kerry the notion that Iraq should be fragmented and should be broken up into many countries. And it is Galbraith who was one of the principal architects of the plan to not only dismantle Iraq, but then Afghanistan. Here is Galbraith, at least a $500 million corrupt figure who deploys his role on behalf of the United States officially to obtain private contracts for himself for a $500 million and more. In fact, as the articles and the evidence about the confrontation between Obama and Karzai reveal the main gravamen of the nominal complaint of Obama and U.S. imperialism about Mr. Karzai is the so-called claim of corruption. Here, Pentagon puts pressure on Hamid Karzai over corruption. The Pentagon's top military officer, the New York Times and Reuters report on March 29th, followed his commander-in-chief to Kabul to keep up pressure on President Hamid Karzai to tackle corruption. Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, arrived less than a day after Barack Obama made his trip there, bringing a stern message that Karzai has to, quote, fight graft, unquote. Obama's strategy, backed by 30,000 more troops, enters its most ambitious phase with a major offensive beginning in June in the Taliban's birthplace, Kandahar. Now, who is the person who was in Afghanistan monitoring the election that they are claiming represented fraud? Who is the person who has been accusing Hamid Karzai of corruption? Who is the person who is orchestrating the plans on the part of the United States to remove Karzai because of his opposition to U.S. designs for permanent war in Afghanistan? Why, it is that avatar of propriety, Peter Galbraith. Peter Galbraith, brothers and sisters, $500 million on the take, Peter Galbraith, who carves up Iraq on behalf of imperialism and enriches himself with billions of dollars.
Our man in Kabul? No longer. And what is he doing meanwhile with his negotiations to try to solidify his position in Afghanistan? Christian Science Monitor, March 22, 2010. Afghan warlord Hekmat Yar talks peace but brings little to the table. The Afghan warlord Gulbuddin Hekmat Yar has sent delegates to Kabul for preliminary peace talks. He's representing his Islami group, meeting with Hamid Karzai. The Hizb-e-Islami forces are focused in the northeast of Afghanistan. Kandahar and the Helmand province, where the U.S. forces are concentrated, are in the south of Afghanistan near the Pakistan border. And these are the largest opium fields of Afghanistan. Hekmat Yar is someone of whom we've spoken for years and years because it's Gulbuddin Hekmat Yar who was most important in the Mujahideen struggles against the Soviets and his collaboration with the CIA.
Well, Maya, if you remember when you and I were in Islamabad and in Rawalpindi and we had a meeting with General Gul Hamid, who was the head of the Pakistani intelligence services during the period that the CIA through Gul Hamid was actually coordinating the funding of Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmat Yar. I said to General Gul Hamid, I said, Hamid, will you tell us, we understand that several billion dollars were deployed by CIA for Gulbuddin Hekmat Yar and Osama bin Laden and the CIA operation to destabilize Afghanistan. Gul Hamid looked at me and said, $50 billion, my dear sir. Brothers and sisters, what are we looking at here? James Dobbins in Foreign Affairs stated, the first Afghan to suggest Hamid Karzai should become president of Afghanistan was in the cockpit of a CIA transport plane heading for Tashkent to Uzbekistan, to Afghanistan's Bagram airfield, where Abdullah and I were to meet with the rest of the Northern Alliance leadership. So, brothers and sisters, their man in Kabul, let's look at their man in Kabul. Wall Street Journal, April 5th. Karzai slams the West again. President Hamid Karzai lashed out at his Western backers for the second time in 3 days, accusing the United States of interfering in Afghan affairs and stating that his government, propped up by billions of dollars in Western aid and nearly 100,000 troops fighting a war against the Taliban, would be compelled, quote, to join the other side. Mr. Karzai blamed resistance to his moves as a foreign conspiracy. The president's latest remarks came less than 24 hours after he assured U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that he would work with the U.S. Publicly, Mr. Karzai has traveled to the southern city of Kandahar with the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, Army General Stanley McChrystal. But Karzai has stated that he will not and does not support U.S. policy any longer. And indeed, Karzai lashed out. Maya?
Ralph, Karzai is trying to reconstruct his Northern Alliance coalition. But what's happened in the years since Gulbuddin Hekmatyar played such an influential role and his Hizbi Islami party was a grand force in Afghanistan, it still remains an organized political force and it is involved in the central government in Afghanistan in some of its ministries. But his militia force has, for the most part, disbanded. As stated by a former Pakistani ambassador to Afghanistan to the Christian Science Monitor, this is Rusham Shah Mohammed, quote, his foot soldiers have joined the mainstream Taliban, so they are now fighting under the banner of the Taliban, and that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar no longer contributes much to the potential insurgency in Afghanistan. Ralph.
Tensions mount between Washington and its puppet in Kabul, writes the World Socialist website. Karzai, the United States and NATO are invaders. They are invaders. They want to destroy my country. In this situation, there's a thin curtain between invasion and domination. The people who are involved in this from the United States really have in mind to destroy Afghanistan. These are the statements by their former man in Kabul, and this is the response of the New York Times and of the rulers. President Karzai lashes out, is the editorial in the New York Times. The rambling speech of President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan was alarming. His delusional criticism of the United Nations and governments whose troops are risking their lives completes the difficult effort to stabilize Afghanistan, and it undermines the fragile public support for President Obama's strategy, which focuses on protecting and improving the lives of Afghan civilians. That effort depends on credible leadership in Kabul. It is now unclear whether Mr. Karzai can provide it, and his latest comments do not help. Now, the New York Times is supplemented by a very instructive op-ed piece by the Hannibal Lecter of American journalists, Thomas Friedman. The article is ominous, and it's called This Time We Really Mean It. Friedman writes, the newspaper carried a very troubling article on the front page on Monday. It detailed how President Hamid Karzai has invited Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to Kabul and is sticking in a thumb in the eye of the Obama administration. After the White House rescinded an invitation to Karzai to come to Washington. That's what we get for risking U.S. soldiers' lives in the thousands and having spent over $200 billion on this regime already. And this is an editorial comment from Friedman, which doesn't leave anything to the imagination. When you don't call things by their real name, he writes, you always get in trouble. The Obama foreign policy team turned a blind eye, saying, Karzai is the best we could get, so let it go. See dictionary for Vietnam. Air Marshal Nguyen Cao Ky, writes Thomas Friedman. Translation, brothers and sisters. After Ngo Dinh Diem was assassinated and murdered by Kennedy and the United States in Vietnam because they didn't consider that he was any longer a sufficiently useful instrument, he was replaced by Air Marshal Nguyen Cao Ky. Thomas Friedman, the New York Times, is in no subtle way putting it out there. Kill him. Physically liquidate him. That's the program. That's the plan. New York Daily News, Cuckoo Karzai, Afghan president strikes out wildly against NATO allies. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is playing with fire as America sends thousands of young men and women to his unstable land to root out al-Qaeda and enable his kind of duly elected government to reassert authority. He has launched an offensive against his would-be saviors, accusing the West and the United States of wanting a puppet government and seeking to make him, quote, psychologically smaller and smaller. They want me to be an illegitimate president. They want the parliament to be illegitimate. No doubt there was massive fraud, he states. It was not done by the Afghans. It's the foreigners who do that. Brothers and sisters, it's very clear. As with Noriega, as with Saddam Hussein, the instruments of imperial rule, when confronted by the real meaning of the devastation of their country, come to the understanding that they have no future, even as a puppet in that society, unless they defy their masters, because survival dictates it if they would remain in any respect a part of the society which is under siege. The human rights dimension of poverty in Afghanistan have nowhere been better articulated than in the United Nations Officer of the High Commissioner for Human Rights report in March 2010. 74% of Afghan's population are rural. 36%, more than one-third, 9 million people, live in abject poverty. 37% live slightly above this poverty line. Two-thirds of Afghan population live in poverty. Poverty is the primary reason children don't go to school. Or if they do, they don't finish primary education. Why girls are married off young. Why 30% of primary school children work and are the sole support of the household. Why maternal mortality is the highest cause of death. Why women cannot go out without a male chaperone. Why women only are allowed to eat after men and guests are fed. While drinking water supplies reach only 23% of Afghans. While 24% of the nation, 1 in 4, is literate. 15 years and older cannot read and write. 12% of the women can read and write. 20% of the population in rural areas can read and write. The majority of Afghans who work do so in an informal economy, vulnerable employment, mostly unskilled labor, highly exploited. Why one Afghan in two has to pay a bribe to a public official, which is almost impossible when you are poor. Why all food aid is stolen by the police. Why only marginal amount reaches the population. Why 3/4 of all aid money is given to the central government in Kabul to distribute amongst officials controlled by the United States. Why 40% of all so-called aid is channeled back to the donor countries through consultant fees, overhead and corporate profits and purchasing supplies. While aid programs have halted because aid workers are being killed and wounded, while the ICRC study found that 96% of all Afghans are devastated by the armed conflict. 76% of the people of Afghanistan have been driven from their homes. Massive numbers of people have been separated from their families. One half of all Afghan families report the loss of a family member as a result of the U.S. invasion, occupation, and domination of Afghanistan, brothers and sisters. What is the real content of the annihilation of Afghanistan? U.S. special forces have covered up massacres of the population of Afghanistan ubiquitously. And we must address this in more detail in subsequent broadcasts, but there is one particular aspect of this which is essential to make clear. We have shot an amazing number of people, but to my knowledge, none has ever proven to be a threat, stated General Stanley McChrystal, the senior American NATO commander in Afghanistan. His comments came during a recent video conference to answer questions from troops in the field about civilian casualties. We have shot an amazing number of people, and none has ever proven to be a threat. We are talking about genocide. We are talking about the annihilation of an entire people. We are talking about a criminal enterprise that discards its puppets who are now defying it. Obama's war in Afghanistan. Destruction there and tyranny at home.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Dysfunctional Capitalist State, Part 5, The Annihilation of Afghanistan, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com.
be picking up in the eye. That's a fact in the past.